and salutations, the Agile Revolution here. Tony with you today, and...
Hi, Renee here, as usual.
And we have a special guest with us today, Dr. Adrian Smith.
Hello, how are you going?
I'm great.
Are you any relation to Craig, who's normally on the show?
No.
We tend to call them the Collective Smith.
Yeah, I think apparently you've got to be Smith to be anyway in Agile.
There's a lot of you around.
A lot of them around, yeah.
Great. So what have you got for us today, Renee, in terms of blogs?
So in terms of interesting blogs or information going out, there was a post a little while back. In fact, it might have been around when the Agile 2011 Salt Lake City Conference was on, by Alistair Coburn. And it was basically saying that he's no longer going to be a certified Scrum trainer.
That's true. Yeah, I saw that.
Mm-hmm.
Gave it away.
So it was quite an interesting blog, and I thought it was well phrased. The context behind of it was, you know, he'd been promoting his own, a side framework or?
I think it's literally a framework. It's not a certification as such.
Mm.
And that's the whole point that he's trying to get through, is that it is a framework to map out, which has not been done, the different ways that you can achieve Agile maturity.
Yep. So basically, he used to be a certified Scrum trainer,
mm-hmm.
used to get quite a lot of money from it.
Mm-hmm.
And when he came through and developed helped assist with a number of people develop this IC Agile program, is that correct?
Correct.
He had a warning letter sent through to him, which he sort of felt was rightly so. It's about sort of almost like a cease and desist statement that if you want to continue to be a trainer, then you need to stop promoting this other framework that exists. And he said that he felt it was fair that slap occurred. So I think it's really big of him to at least realise that. But I think in some ways it probably gave him the opportunity to take a step back going, okay, where do I really think this should be going, and pulling his support as a certified Scrum trainer.
Yeah, I think the point there was he didn't pull his support. What he said was that he no longer wanted to do the Scrum training because he wanted to concentrate on the IC Agile framework, right?
Right.
If you read the blog right to its contentious end, at the end of it, he does say, as an addendum, that he still thinks Scrum is quite neat.
Yes.
To quote him, I believe.
If only it got, what was it, updated more? Or?
Yeah, I can't remember the exact wording.
If you boil Agile down to a minimum, you pretty much get Scrum. It's not actually a methodology. It is one entry in what I consider a more interesting category, the reflective improvement frameworks. That makes it doubly neat and maybe even harder to define. But he does say near the end, so that was postscript, but also near the end that he wishes someone would write down the definition of Scrum in the Hilltop style so that people will not get confused about what it is and what it isn't Scrum.
Mm.
So that's about trying to label what is Agile and what isn't Agile, which is pretty hard to do these days.
Adrian, you were there at the conference. Did you talk much about it?
So I don't think Alistair actually spoke at the conference about this topic. There was what I did note was that there was a fair bit of promotion for the IC Agile framework.
From him or from a number of people?
And a number of people. There was brochures and handouts and stuff like that.
So I think Ahmed Sibki would have been the other one, I think, is the
partner. Yeah, and I noticed that Alistair spent a little bit of time, PMI had a booth in the exhibitors hall,
yep.
And Alistair spent a bit of time advocating the PMI Agile certification path, because I think it's compatible with his IC Agile framework.
Yeah, I think what he calls it is his IC Agile, if I'm not wrong, it's a learning roadmap of all accreditations and rationalities.
And that's based upon your role, isn't it?
Correct, yeah.
So you learn what's applicable to your role and what elements of Agile are applicable to your role.
Yeah, and I think it's what they're striving to do that's different to what's been done before is it actually gives you a pathway of all the things in one place where you find all of the accreditations that you've achieved.
Yeah.
So regardless of the rationality.
So is it actually competing with certified Scrum Master Training?
I think it is competing in so much that it's diluting the market share that Certified Scrum Master has.
Yep.
Because when people are looking for, you know, I want to hire someone, I don't know their background, and I'm looking for things on their resume that points out that they've got a commitment to their profession.
Yep.
And then they show certified Scrum Master or certified Scrum Practitioner or whatever. It does show that they're committed to, you know, their learning and professional development. And I don't think there's anything else probably in the market that's really been competing with that. So
yeah.
In some ways, Scrum, it has had a stranglehold on the market.
Yeah.
And I think this will go to some ways cutting into that market share.
So whilst in reality it's creating an alternate certification path, it's there more as a competing market?
So I think what you have to be careful about there is that, yeah, IC Agile itself is not giving you any accreditation, right, in terms of the accreditations are earned. Well, this is my understanding.
My understanding is also that IC Agile is endorsing other training pathways to achieving maturity of competency and practice within Agile. So you may have chosen training X, and that's been endorsed by IC Agile, and that gives you to a certain level. You may have achieved that level through Scrum training or through, you know.
So it's more of a holistic approach.
Yeah, I think it embraces other things, and whereas the Scrum is a little bit more exclusive, as you're either in or you're out.
So I think obviously we're sort of doing a number of assumptions here, so we can't speak definitively on the cases of IC Agile, but it's probably worthwhile going to some depth of it later on and being a bit more informed for the listeners out there.
Yeah, I think so. I think I was just looking through it very quickly, because you're saying the roadmap of the education for the entire industry is something it's working on a lot at the moment. And it's working across organisational boundaries with certification bodies such as PMI, IIBA, ISTQB, Valtech, Software Education, Agile Academy, ThoughtWorks, Solo Trainers, Shore Communications, Australian National Broadband Network and companies. And we are working to make the learning objectives time box methodologies like XP Scrum, also for Lean Kanban and Naked Planning approaches. So they're really going across all variants of it, which I think is really good.
Great. Well, that's the only article I wanted to talk about. It was very surprising for me to see, you know, a leader in the Agile community make such a bold statement. I think it's great. What about you, Tony?
As usual, I have nothing. I've lucked upon this little blog written by Aaron Erickson from informatit.com. It says, everybody's Agile, doing Agile, why can't we? And it had some really interesting things there. Some of the things in there I've seen done and said before, you know, things about can you handle the truth, and the reason that people aren't doing Agile well is because they can't handle the truth, you know, things around dot points of can you miss this budget number this quarter, and, you know, target points this iteration, what happens if a salesperson's missed their quota, and all these things that people don't want to really see. And the thing about Agile is that it makes it very transparent, right? There are quite a number of really good topics in here about risk management. It's a very, very involved blog, so I'm not going to go into the whole thing. Talks about organising yourself for failure, but one of the bits that I really like is the misuse of metrics. Because I think one of the things I see that there's often a lot of failings around is how metrics are used. And I love this. There's a particular quote in here. I'm going to have trouble finding it now. Here it is. Yeah. So he says, and I'm just going to quote this little paragraph for me. There's a lot more in here, it's really good, but he says, similar to how bad organization model hinders agility, bad metrics can have the same effect. One of the lauded things about metrics is the concept of what gets measured gets done. Now, we've all heard that euphemism, right?
Yep.
But definitely. He actually turns around, and I love this. It just so happens, however, that one of the most dangerous things about metrics is its evil twin. What doesn't get measured gets ignored in favour of what is being measured.
Agreed, yep.
So, and from there I thought that it strikes a very pointed note for me, because I see that happen quite a lot.
But you don't want to measure everything,
no,
do you?
No, and he's not saying that, but sometimes I don't think that, sometimes you can go into areas where they're measuring things and then they particularly say, we've got all the measurements we need, but are they the right measurements?
Mm. I think that there's a point here that the absence of measurement leads to a lack of discipline, I think, or how do I say it differently? if we're not measuring anything, I think there's a culture of not making a commitment to do things. And I think some measurements, even though they may be not the right measurements, are better than having no measurements.
Some measurements are so damn hard. When you talk about a lot of intangible related things, and you're talking about people-based things, it can get really quite difficult.
Yeah, there's definitely a challenge in what to measure and how to measure it so we, you know, get the right system outcome, not necessarily the individual outcome.
Yeah, so when your metrics aren't carefully aligned with your business value, that can be a problem.
Mm.
Yeah, and he does say that in here somewhere. It says when they're not carefully aligned, they create behaviours that work against the creation of business value.
Mm.
Because you can become metric driven against a metric that's actually against what you're trying to deliver.
Mm.
So if you get a chance to read that one, it's not bad.
We'll post it in the show notes.
We'll post it in the show notes. Adrian, you got anything you want to contribute? You read anything that floated your boat?
I've seen a couple of good write-ups from the Agile 2011 conference. Rob Myers, who's an Agile coach, has circulated a post, which is good. I'll give you that link that we can put up.
Excellent.
It was a really good detailed explanation of how the conference went and some really good highlights that he pulled out, photos and all sorts of stuff.
So like a reflection on the conference?
Yeah, probably from his experience, so that was cool. Probably a couple of other little things about technical debt and stuff like that. I mean, I'm probably following more the Ruby on Rails community as much as I'm following the Agile community, so I sort of get dominated there. Probably more noisy than the Agile.
Noisy as in purist?
More opinionated.
Opinionated. Yeah. We like a highly opinionated revolution.
Yeah.
Okay.
So, which I think is good. I mean, this is sort of one of the things that's a key thing with the Rails as a framework, is that it's intended to be opinionated software. It's convention over configuration. So they're noisy about the right way to do things or what they perceive as the right way to do things.
Is it very similar to what the Java community was like, you know, ten years ago? Yeah.
I don't know, because I wasn't probably in the Java community at that time. I think one of the things that with the Rails community you notice, and Ruby in general, is that people have a strong appreciation of design, and so they're less tolerant of things which don't feel right or feel awkward or clumsy. You know, the fact that Mac hardware and tooling dominates the developer environment in that space is in some ways a reflection of the type of people that are in that environment. That they appreciate good design, they like things that are as simple as possible but no simpler, and that is in some ways a firewall for the types of people that get attracted and work in that environment.
Yeah,
I like it.
Mm.
Anything else? We got anything more? Shall we move on?
Quote of the week. I got this as a tweet from the PM coach, and he says, too few people on a project can't solve the problems, too many create more problems than they can solve.
I've heard a quote which is similar to that, and I'm not going to get it right, the quote, but it's something like, the real problem is not what to do with the people on the project, it's what to do with the people after the project's finished, which is sort of along the same lines.
You know, in essence, it's talking about the fact that there's always going to be more problems than you can possibly solve on the project, because there's not enough people that are focused on actually solving problems. And I saw this, and I saw a picture in my mind of, and you would know this as coaches, you walk into a lot of retrospectives where you know nothing about the team. You just ask to fill in, or you're asked to facilitate that particular retrospective, and you don't know anything about the environment. And you get a feel for the people and how well they bond as a team, just as they're conducting and participating in the retrospectives as to whether they're well bonded or not. But where I felt this really quite applicable and where it reflected in my mind was that you see where the different post-it notes go up in the quadrants. So, you know, I actually use a four quadrant system of what worked well, lessons learnt, what to do differently next time, and what still puzzles us. And by the number of post-it notes in the quadrant, it tells me a lot about the team behaviour. So when I see a lot of post-it notes in the what still puzzles us and a little bit in the what to do different next time, it indicates to me a team that's just forming and just starting to storm, and there's a lot of open questions out there. When it gets into that, a lot more into that differently next time, there's a lot of storming, conforming behaviours and a lot of churn going on inside of the team behaviourally. And then as the projects go on, as the team starts acting as a team together and working successfully, when you get near the end of the projects, you'll get a whole pile of stuff in the what worked well, a whole pile of lessons learned, and a lot less on that right-hand side of what to change and what puzzles people.
I think it's interesting you say that you use a quadrant for the lessons learned thing, because I think that's something I don't do enough of, is helping to promote a culture of a learning environment within the team. And I think that's almost calling that out as something.
It's been used for me. I've used it for 8 years now. And the reason why is that it's that concept of focusing on positives and negatives and not focusing unevenly on them. So a lot of people talk about, and happy to say, what's worked well and to celebrate that, but what have we learnt that we don't want to continue to do again, or achieved from a success perspective.
I like that. The other failing that I see with teams that where they're first starting their retrospectives is they really don't get down to the root cause either.
No.
There's a lot of airy fairy stuff up there.
Yep.
And for me, that just creates a problem. There's a lot of it becomes a bitch fest. It becomes something to hang on the wall like a nice tapestry. But if they come out of that with some very clear, definable actions and work through the problem-solving process of digging down to the next level to cause those problems,
yep,
then you've got issues as well.
Mm.
And I see that a lot.
But have you felt that before when you've been a coach working in doing retrospectives and just visually taking a step back going, how many post-it notes are in the section, and actually forming patterns of that over time in your mind about how that relates to certain team behaviours?
I have to admit that I haven't, but I will.
Mm. Yeah, I don't think I have. I mean, I've probably seen it more from if you do a longitudinal retrospective at the end of a project where we do something like a timeline and we get individual markers and show over time how we felt things were going and then seeing a trend over time. So I've sort of seen a similar sort of thing from that perspective.
It'd be interesting to actually have on a project graph over time the number of post-it notes in each quadrant. Just seeing where it actually shifted over the project, I think you'll find that there's quite a consistent pattern that occurs from project to project.
Mm.
I like it. Anything else?
Yep.
Any quotes? No? My favourite quote of the day at the moment is, amateurs work until they get it right. Professionals work until they can't get it wrong.
Yeah. So for me, that goes back to Daniel Pink's mastery and drive and how we try and drive ourselves to be better at what we're doing.
Yeah.
But that second element about when you're at a professional layer, you're no longer learning. You're experimenting, you're innovating, aren't you?
Yeah, so it's about the shuha and the re that we often talk about. So you can drag it back to that.
Yep, exactly.
And it really is. And as you know, I love that.
Yes, good. You and your shoes.
Me and my shoes. I'm pretty happy with my rees as well.
What about you, Adrian? Have you seen anything recently quote-wise?
No, not really.
And, we sprung that on you, so that's fair.
I would have come prepared.
He would have come prepared. He'd have written this letter if only he could find the time.
Yeah, that's right. I would have made a point.
There's my Mark Twain quote. I got it in there for Craig. It's one of his favourites.
So with Adrian here, we have the fantastic opportunity to talk about Agile 2011 at Salt Lake City. You were there, you had the awfully long flight there and back again. How long is your flight?
So it's 13 hours from Brisbane to LA, and then it's a 2-hour flight to Salt Lake City. It wasn't all that bad. I mean, Craig and I travelled together, so that was sort of made a bit of fun. But we were tired definitely when we got there, and I was surprised how hot it was actually there. It was like 40 degrees Celsius. Which was pretty hot, dry.
It's their summertime, right?
Yeah, it's summer. I mean, I knew it was going to be summertime, but I didn't expect it to be quite that hot there.
And how'd you go with the altitude?
I didn't have any problem. I think some people I did hear, got headaches and stuff like that. And I noticed I was probably had to drink more water than I probably realised I should have.
Was it first time in Salt Lake City?
First time in Salt Lake City, yeah.
And did you get religion?
No, I didn't get
it. Did you get an extra wife?
No, I didn't. Apparently, I don't think that's legal anymore.
Okay.
I think that has been outlawed a while ago.
Sorry for anyone listening for that stereotype.
There is a local beer they have called Polygamy Porter, and the tagline on it is "Why have just one?" So
I like it.
But so we went for a bit of a tour of the Mormon facilities there. They've got it spread over like four city blocks. There's, you know, very impressive, you know, infrastructure of churches and Mormon tabernacle and stuff like that.
That would have been impressive to see, actually. Mm.
Yeah, it is.
So how many people were there?
The conference, I think, was around 1,700 people in attendance, and it was, I think, 16 concurrent streams over 5 days.
16 sessions going on at once?
Yeah, concurrently.
Wow. And obviously that means that you didn't get to see everything that was going on.
No, definitely not, yeah. So in many instances it was, you know, weighing up between what we'd like to see and what we can see and stuff like that. And because I was, you know, working closely with Craig there, we'd often split our time and go to different sessions
and compare notes
and that sort of thing.
So hit us with your highlights, Adrian. That's what we're looking for.
So I guess my highlights, I can only speak from the ones that I did see.
Yeah.
So apologies if I'm missing out on any big ticket ones. So one of the key things, I guess, is that the day before the conference, there's a functional testing group that meets each time on the day before the conference. And so Craig and I went to that, and that was a small set of maybe 25 or 30 people there, all talking about automated functional testing and acceptance test-driven development and that sort of thing, and some of the challenges. And that was really an opportunity to really talk with practitioners doing stuff. And in some ways, I got a lot more out of that session than actually going to talks that were well prepared, because those sort of, we had sessions and
Is there actually doing in that session?
It wasn't really as much doing, but you know, we talked about, you know, syntax rules for the Gherkin language for cucumber, and we talked about all the challenges implementing ATDD, and we talked about, you know, new tooling that's coming on, and we had demos and that, and you know, we were fortunate enough to have Ward Cunningham came and gave a demonstration of his new distributed wiki that we were seeing for the first time. So that was pretty exciting to see that.
So what's a distributed
wiki? I'm not sure I fully grasped it, but he demonstrated the technology where we had two independent wiki websites, and he could drag content between the two, which was pretty
in real time.
In real time, yeah.
Wow. And Wood Cunningham is an icon in his own right.
He is an icon. Yeah. Yeah. I mean, to me, when as part of the conference, there was a reunion of, you know, the people who authored the manifesto, the 15 people. I think they got 11 or 12 of the original 15, mm-hmm. which Ward Cunningham is one of them, and yeah, he was one of the people who stood out to me when they had a discussion on their reflections on the manifesto. So yeah.
So what did he say on the reflections on the manifesto?
Gee.
Oh, you're hurting him now. You're hurting him.
I'm not sure.
Okay.
I don't have that ready, but in my mind. But I remember that. I guess the clarity with which he spoke about the decision and the environment in which they formulated the manifesto was really the thing that I took away from more than actual content snippets or anything like that.
And I think, you know, you were there the night that we were talking to Alistair about how it all went down as well. So I was interested to see if you got some more parallels with that conversation.
So it was actually surprising that Alistair's recollection to you and I that evening was quite close to, you know, what was the group, how the group expressed how it went down. It, you know, one thing that people, you know, called out was, you know, why was there 15, you know, Anglo-Saxon males?
I saw their answer to that. It was very
as opposed to no feminine response and no ethnic response.
Well, they put out the call, and the females took one look at the bunch and said, no thanks very much.
Yes.
That was their answer. So, yeah.
It was the balding heads that sort of detracted them from wanting to go, wasn't it?
Maybe 10 years ago they looked better. But.
So that was pretty good, yes. Okay.
Hmm.
So what else?
So highlights, other highlights from the conference. So that was definitely a big highlight. That was, you know, 90 minutes of those guys on stage answering questions and talking about the manifesto and, you know, would they have changed anything in it? And I think the general consensus was they wouldn't. you know, mm-hmm. they're pretty happy with it. I think the only comment was that they might add the clause, and we really mean it, which is sort of Ron Jeffries making that point.
Yeah, I think the only one that I've heard them say, I've heard a couple of them say over the years, is that probably removing the word software.
Mm.
So I was interested to see if that came out again.
Potentially development too?
I don't know. Yeah, I can always talk about that one that I've heard that from a couple of them. So.
So if they really mean it, what does that mean ultimately? Really, does that mean that they're really going to be, you know, evangelical about it?
Yeah, don't F with it. They tried it the other way.
I mean, I think like it's written as a manifesto, and it's in I guess in writing a manifesto, you're trying to create something that you can be passionate about and it can rally people to think in a certain way. You know, like if you think about other manifestos, like not one springing to mind apart from the Unabomber.
Oh, nice. Yeah.
There's
a half-assed manifesto.
Mein Kampf. Yeah, there's probably some. Karl Marx probably created a manifesto.
So we're getting a theme manifestos are tied to some really bad stuff.
Yeah, I think we might have just pulled the bad ones.
Not someone bad, but people are passionate about a topic, I think. You know, so I think the really meaning it is about, you know, we really mean it. We're passionate about this, and, you know, this is our collective view of what we need to do to make things successful.
But don't you think people might take that away as going, I need to be a zealot now about this?
That's an interesting take, and I think if they go away taking that out, then they lost the true essence of it in the first place.
Mm-hmm.
So, you know, I've always had a problem with evangelising as opposing to be a pragmatist.
Yeah. But can you be pragmatic with the manifesto? That's really what it comes down to.
Well, I mean, I don't think it's exclusive in any sense, because, you know, all it's saying is that we value one thing greater than another.
Over the other, yeah.
Over the other. We're not saying that the right-hand side has no value. All we're saying is that the left-hand side has more value.
And I think that's the point that's often lost on newbies, sceptics, and detractors.
Mm.
That they see the stuff on...
Zealots, too.
And zealots, that they basically say, everything there is the important stuff, and you said you didn't value it. They miss that piece of saying that we do value that.
I mean,
we
especially
value
with the documentation thing. I mean, I think that there's many myths that, you know, agile equals no documentation. And I talk to teams, especially ones that are needing documentation for, you know, either certification or some regulatory thing. You know, if documentation is an important part of your business as a deliverable, you know, then make it part of the way you deliver. And
I've always talked about it being a risk-based decision about how much documentation is right and why do you need the documentation, what's the intent of it and who's it there for, who's the audience.
Mm-hmm. I also find some of the missing keys to the castle, I call it, is the principles as well. A lot of people don't bother to read past the first part of the manifesto, right?
Mm.
And there are a number of those key principles that are very important and answer a number of the key questions.
Yeah, I think they definitely extend the view. Is there 12, I think?
There is 12 principles.
Yep. 12 principles. Yeah, so...
It's 12 dwarves too.
12 dwarves.
12 reindeers, is that right?
Yeah, they could...
12
days of Christmas. Yeah, 12 days of Christmas. I don't know about the reindeer.
Was it 10 reindeers?
Yeah, but then there is only 4 members of the Wiggles, so that sort of brings it all down.
I always sort of felt that the documentation one was interesting. Why not increase it to also include meetings? Because some meetings I just find so useless.
Yeah, but I think that, you know, you can answer the question of that is people need to ask whether that meeting has value.
Same with documentation.
And the same answer.
Yeah. So I want them to change it to add meetings in there as well.
Yeah.
Get rid of the software word.
Yeah.
Get rid of the development word.
I mean, they talked a little bit also about the software craftsmanship movement and how they've sort of taken the view of, okay, let's add something further to the left-hand side and we further value this. Which follows along the same lines, and I think an interesting extension to the idea.
Look, all in all, for a 10-year journey,
bloody good.
I think it's stood the test of time. It's continually improving and is continually gaining. So for me, that's a true testament to to the capability of it.
But the manifesto and the principles haven't changed for a very long time.
No, no. I didn't mean actually the movement itself had moved and changed.
I just thought it was interesting for a community that's based upon continuously improving and reflecting and so forth that there has been zero adjustment.
I think that comes down to the old, it doesn't matter how much of that you have, you always have to have a good grounding or a framework or something, right?
What else?
What else? So the keynotes, the two keynotes at the end were, I thought, really, really impressive. The first one was Kelvin Henney, who's a guy from the UK. He's written a number of books in design patterns. His talk was entitled Code, and he was a fantastically entertaining...
Well, just code?
Called Code, C-O-D-E. And he did show some code. He showed Quine and a few other things, and examples of it, you know, how code is pervasive in our life and things like that. And he was, yeah, fantastically entertaining. The other talk as a keynote was Linda Rising's talk about the agile mindset, which she talked a lot about a fixed mindset versus an agile mindset, where a fixed one is being, I guess, closed to change, and an agile one being more open to change. And she cited a number of experiments, sort of psychology experiments, that have, I guess, originated through work with children about, if they're given a certain environment, they can develop in certain ways. And it comes back a lot to, I guess, this idea of neuroplasticity, about how flexible the brain is to adapt.
Mm-hmm.
And one of the things that came out for me is that, you know, they did experiments, I think, in the 70s with monkeys where they put them in a fairly static environment and looked at the growth of their brain cells and how they did or didn't recover.
Oh, okay.
And the monkeys were in an environment where they didn't get much stimulation. I'm probably botching this description of the experiment, so look it up yourself.
That's okay, we don't make any claims to be actually accurate here.
The intent, it's all disclaimed. What they concluded was that, you know, your certain amount of brain cells you've got, they don't grow or get replaced over time. But their experiment was flawed because the environment which they put the monkeys in didn't provide any stimulation for the monkeys, so that there was no response to stimulus, so their brains didn't grow. So this assumption that our brains don't recover or don't grow new brain cells has been something that's been an assumption within sort of medical science for 30 years.
But I thought it's been disproven for a couple of years now, hasn't it?
Disproven.
It's been disproven.
Not the case, which, yeah, you know, is the whole neuroplasticity thing where you can change and you're not in a fixed mindset.
Which goes and rules the buffalo theory, really. I've always worked on the buffalo theory. Mm-hmm. When the great herds migrate, the buffaloes migrate. All the weak ones get picked off by the denizens, leaving only the strong. Well, I've always worked on that. When you drink, it gets rid of all the weak brain cells and only leaves the strong ones. Now I know that other ones are going to grow up. I might end up with a whole batch of new weak ones. That's not going to do me any favours.
Well, you just have to drink again.
Ah.
I mean, I think Linda Rising was using herself as an example because, you know, she's in her 70s now. She completed her PhD when she was 50.
Not young.
You know, and she's still, you know...
Still chugging along.
On the up and up. Wow. So, you know, she's a living testament to that.
That's
great. She also talked about quite a lot of stuff about praise and children and you know, what you can do as a parent.
Great.
Which was interesting.
And you sent some of that article around, didn't you?
The article that she referred to was one that was published in the New York Times magazine about how not to talk to your children, and the basic premise is that praise can be quite detrimental to children because they become dependent on extrinsic motivation for what they do in life, rather than having motivation from their own internal intrinsic forms.
So that's it, Renee. From now on, you're not getting a thank you or anything from me and tell you that you're good.
I'm not a good girl.
No. You're a bad girl.
Sad face. How was your own presentation?
So the presentation was good. So we had an hour. Craig and I did a back and forth. He spoke, I spoke. We were one of the few presentations that were actually video recorded. So
so we get to see your ugly mug in the future.
Should be able to see my ugly mug in the future.
Well, we'd like to see the link for that, because we'll add it to the...
I'm not sure. I think they're still being edited and...
Great.
And because they were professionally videoed, which I found a little bit disconcerting, having never been videoed before when I was presenting, not knowing whether to look at the camera, look at Craig, look at the audience, look at my feet, or what. So that was a little bit... disconcerting. However, the talk went really well. I mean, we were talking about the future of testing and how do we empower the testers within an organization, and the title was Accelerating the Speed to Cool for Testing. And
how can testing be cool, Adrian?
It is. I think the thing is, agile makes testing cool.
I think
when did I hear testing? No.
So we got lots of good feedback, and we had a bit of crowd interaction and stuff like that. So
how many people did you have?
Probably about 100.
Maybe. Oh, that's good.
That's good size.
You should be happy with that.
Yeah.
And all accounts, I heard that it went well. There were some good Twitter feeds going on at the time, and I didn't see any bad ones.
No negative results.
So.
I think the audience were not the Twittering kind as well. Like there's other.
What you're saying? Wait. Are you saying testers aren't Twitterers?
I think the
test... You're starting to damage the cool factor.
Well, it's not necessarily all cool. But there's certain, I guess, types of people who are more Twitter. I mean, maybe they were just so engaged with the talk they didn't have time.
Yeah, well, that's... Stick with that.
But we were looking at the Twitter feed afterwards and thought, oh, we were hoping for more. I mean, it's some ways... disappointing that a lot of talks get boiled down just to a series of little sound bites,
Very true.
Are just the tweets or the memes coming out of the talk.
But those sound bites are those aha moments, those elements that mean something.
Yeah, I know. I mean, I've been guilty of boiling a talk down to a couple of little tweets.
Look, we'd love to have the link to that when it actually happens, so we can link it to the Agile Revolution.
Yeah, no problem.
That would be fantastic to have. Mm-hmm. Well.
Practice of the week
is introduce
limiting work in progress.
One close to everyone's heart, and Adrian, for our listeners, is a lean proponent as well.
Yeah, that's right. Limiting work in progress is an enormous thing. I mean, one of the things that we're pushing in Innova is.
So we better stop right there, and we'll get that plug in while we're at it.
Okay.
Adrian, tell us a little bit about Innova.
Was that a shameless self-promotion?
That was a shameless self-promotion, but you know what? We're all about that.
Is trying to apply agile and lean practices into construction. Because if you think about it, you want to start a construction job, you're building a garden shed, you've got 3/4 of the material, so you decide to start and you do a bit, and you realise you run out of material, so you start another bit to it. And if you imagine this process magnitude by $100 million project, it becomes an extremely inefficient way to build something. So you're actually a lot better to actually stop, make sure you make ready all the packages of work that you want to work on, and then execute them, with all the dependencies in place, so that you then actually don't keep opening up different work faces and expanding your work in progress.
So what is limiting work in progress at its heart?
To me, it's minimising the amount of context switching. It's taking one task and taking it to its definition of done before starting a new task. Because the cost of changing tasks partway through and then putting something down, picking it up, starting a new task is actually quite expensive. It may not seem like it, and it may feel like you're being really productive because you've got keeping 10 things on the go, but you're actually... cheating yourself.
So that element, sorry, Tony, of changing tasks, that's what you're calling context switching. Yeah.
And I was also going to say, if you see it also, it's also the art of maximising the removal of waste as well.
Mm-hmm.
Yes, yeah, so that's what I've learned out of Lean Experts, is that it's not just about reducing the context switching that's going on, but it's also about having a small enough set of work going on so that the probable causes of having roadblocks and issues come up is significantly reduced, and the areas where that's actually resulting from is limited, because you've actually got a very limited set of work in progress.
Mm. And in the case of construction, if you're just doing the work that's the planned work, that means you're actually managing the critical path. Because in many instances, if you're opening up new work faces, you're not necessarily working on addressing the critical path of the program.
Excellent.
So what happens in context switching, a lot of people probably aren't aware of this, is that every single time that you mentally shift from one task to the other, you're incurring a productivity loss. And it's been proven time and time again. In fact, it's a really easy experiment to prove that when you're doing it, you're resulting in a 20% productivity loss. Now, this loss is not just once off. So if you're juggling many things mentally in your head, every single time you're adding something in, it's another 20%. It's a cumulative effect. So it can jump up quite high. If you're juggling five things at once, you're practically 0% effective.
And it's actually quite stressful as well.
Very stressful.
When I know personally when I've got lots of things on, that, it creates anxiety and you're worrying about am I forgetting something or whatever.
And I think the other part of that is the part of that limiting the work progress is having that prescripted process that you can fall back on. A lot of times when you see that it's not going well is that it's a very ad hoc process that people have just cobbled together, right? And then how are you supposed to actually improve if you don't have a standard?
Yeah.
And often you don't see that there's a baseline standard of where you need to be to start with, and how are you going to improve if you don't have a baseline standard in the first place?
So in applying this particular practice, what's very important is that if you have your own progress wall or your own story wall, and you have a look at the work that is currently in progress. Let's assume you have some sort of in progress or some sort of code or some develop column, that you only have yourself allocated to one item at a time, that you're not spreading yourself too much, that your name or your avatar is up just in one spot on that board.
I like that. I'll go with that. In fact, I think one of the things about this, there's no such thing as overestimation, is a quote that I read. There's only overcommitting.
Yep.
And I think that happens a lot. And you see that where the work in progress is really not being controlled, as people have gone, we can do this, 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 and this, and this, and you really have overestimated what you're actually capable of.
I think it's a symptom we often see on people's story walls is that there's lots of stuff actually shown in the work in progress column, but they're actually not working on it.
Correct. They're not touching it.
Not touching it that day.
Yep. Yeah.
You know, in some ways it needs to be either moved back.
Correct.
So that you can only physically have one thing that you're working on at that time. But, we've sort of it's become acceptable to say, okay, yeah, I'm going to be doing it this week, so therefore it's work in progress.
And a nice way of actually enforcing that is to have only one avatar for that person at a time. So you can only have one avatar up for yourself at a time.
I like it. Although you could electrocute them every time they touch more than two, but, that would work as well.
So that's all we've got time for today.
Hey, come on, I have to add the humour to the podcast, right?
I'd like to thank Adrian for coming along.
Thank you. Now, what we must do is very quickly, Dr. Adrian Smith comes from Inova to us.
Yep.
Look up Adrian's company. What's your company's website for us, Adrian?
It's inova.com.au.
And principally, what do you do?
How do you spell that?
ENNOVA.
Yep. And just give us a very 2-second whistle stop who you are.
We are agile consulting, software development, construction, lean and agile company.
Hence is the shameless plug. Continue on, Renee.
So thanks everyone for listening. If you want to find out more information, you can check us out on theagilerevolution.com. You can also email us at podcast@theagilerevolution.com. You can email me at Renee, renee@theagilerevolution.com.
Or me at tony@theagilerevolution.com. Or Craig. Although I don't think he's going to answer at the moment because he's on holidays.
Yeah, though hopefully he might be back for the next session.
Well, we'll see.
So Craig and I are speaking next week at Stans in Melbourne.
Lovely. So we'll have a little bit more fire.
It won't be next week.
It won't be next week. How ill-informed we are about our cast members. Excellent. Thanks very much, Adrian.
Thank you.
And goodbye. Viva la revolution.